This is an idea we've been starting to throw around about using storage class memory for archives, so we'll dive right in here. When you're dealing with archival storage, as most of us know, due to its long life and low usage, your total cost per byte over time is the bottom line. Now, because of this, magnetic media, your tape and your disk approaches really dominate because they've got the lowest acquisition costs. We started actually looking at storage class memory, which despite its really high acquisition costs, it looks like it has the ability to have much lower running costs and infrastructure needs. Also, they're physically robust, and this means that they're tougher, and so they should actually have a longer device lifetime, which is appealing in an archival storage sense, because we want something that can survive benign neglect, something that could be pulled off a shelf, left someplace for a few years, come back, plug it in, and it'd have a reasonable chance of working. So based on this, we're arguing that we should really start looking at these storage class memory approaches such as flash, phase change, and maybe memristors in the near future for archiving, particularly if we can combine these low infrastructure needs and the longer device lifetimes with a degree of self-management, we should be able to get a nice low total cost of operation. So keeping our discussion at a really high level, what are some of the advantages of taking a storage class memory approach? There's low power and infrastructure needs. There's negligible power use when idle, and it's relatively low even under a very heavy load. They're physically light, and they're vibration tolerant while generating no vibration themselves. They're physically tough. Some of the studies we've seen show that they're resilient to relatively high temperatures. They're much more resistant to physical shock. This is something with a suitable enclosure. You can drop it, and it has a reasonable chance of working, while with some of these disk and tape-based approaches, if you drop it, you're done. There's also a lower likelihood of total device failure. These are solid state devices. There's no moving parts. So there's longer physical device lifetime, but as we've seen in some of the studies that have come up recently with flash, there's a higher likelihood of individual bit failure that has to be accounted for. So looking a little bit more at the storage class memory, we'll also look at some of the data retention times. Now, they aren't as high as are predicted on some models of tape, but they're still competitive. Some models of flash, 10 plus years on the shelf. But as we'll discuss a little bit further in a moment, is that there is an inverse relationship between the number of write cycles it takes and its estimated data retention time, which needs to be accounted for. Memristors, very early in their lifetime, some of the slides I've seen come out of HP estimate years to millennia. It'd be great if that happens. I'll believe it when I see it, though. Phase change memory, seen some estimates up as high as 10 years. They have good performance. Now, oftentimes when we're thinking about archives, we tend to put performance to the side and go, we don't need to worry about it, but it actually has a lot of benefits. You have no spin-up or tape mounting. You have no mechanical wear. The fast performance can be used to improve reliability. We can have faster rebuild and faster and more frequent integrity checking. But as we mentioned earlier, there's the high acquisition cost to deal with, and the characteristics of storage class memories, particularly the up-and-coming ones, aren't very well understood at the moment. So comparing to magnetic media, what are the ups and downs here? Disk's cheap, it's dense, and has very good random access performance for the most part, but they're mechanically complicated, and they're only getting more so. We have heat-assisted magnetic recording coming up, as well as shingled writes. This means that we're going to add even more whole device failure modes. They also require significant infrastructure at large scale. Large racks of disks are very, very heavy, they're vibration sensitive, and they're relatively power hungry. All of this adds to the total cost of operation of fitting out and running your data center. Now, how about tape? Tape's very cheap to acquire, has a good long estimated shelf life, and it's low power. But as it turns out, tape actually doesn't always scale down very well or up. It has odd sweet spots. Tapes also can themselves be maintenance intensive. Some models of tapes you have to account for retensioning, dust cleaning. It can also be very, very difficult to migrate large numbers of tapes when you're reaching a vendor shift. They also have good streaming performance, but very poor random access performance, and some of the archival workloads we are beginning to see actually are very, very dependent on having good random access performance in order to have an effective archive. So the architecture we're starting to toy around with, if you're familiar with Pergamum or Fawn, this should be old hat. The idea is to take some sort of storage class memory and a system board, CPU, RAM, a communication interface, and make a very simple, low-powered node. The idea is that we can use this to make the system self-managing and also make infrastructure requirements a little bit easier to deal with rather than having a complicated server where you're going to have to diagnose individual components. Just go in there, take out a tome, put another one in there, and move on. We also would leverage the system board for a degree of self-management. We want them to be able to integrity check themselves as well as do their own replica management and be indexing, be self-indexing as well. So to wrap up here, we need a lot more investigation in this area, though. One of the biggest needs we see is we need more characterization of current and future storage class memories. What's their data retention look like? What impacts data retention? Do they have read disturb? Are there write endurance issues? What are the predicted bit error rates? What are the real bit error rates? We also need more cost analysis. This is always a bit of a bugbear, but we really need to look at opportunity costs and infrastructure needs on a very detailed quantitative basis, particularly opportunity costs, because we're pushing these long-lived small devices and many of them all at once. So how is this going to shift our economic model when we have something that we might want to leave on the shelf for 5 years, but storage density is always increasing? So what costs are we incurring there? Finally, since we're also pushing this model of using many, many simple, slow-power independent nodes, how do we scale up, automate, and manage it to 100,000-plus nodes? And I'd also like to point out we do have a tech report out on this and open it up to questions and comments.
Hi, Eric Reddell from EMC. Do you think you're going to need to access them regularly, like do scrubbing, or you really think you can let them sit around for 5 years or 10 years at a time?
The hand-wavy answer is it really depends. We've been doing a lot of workload analysis recently, and it is archival storage is demonstrating a lot of growth in breadth of the types of workloads we're seeing. It's no longer just write once, read maybe. We've seen some stuff where people actually come in and they periodically update their data. Other times they just leave it on a shelf, they never look at it, and it's all over the place.
Okay. Peter Desnoyers. I was wondering, actually, using Flash in an application like this makes me wonder if you might think about temperature effects, and in particular for a system like that, whether actually cooling your whole system down will give you a better shelf life, given that if it's archival, hopefully you'll have a relatively low write rate to minimize those effects.
I personally haven't considered that, but that's one of the things why we're pitching we need more characterization of current and future storage class memories. That's an excellent point.
Can I?
Oh, no, you can ask. Yeah. I'll ask.
So Eric Reddell, ex-Seagate. I'd encourage you to take a serious look at what a drive technology, so a Rust-based technology, would do with this kind of workload. I mean, on the shelf for 10 years. I mean, a lot of the things that cause drives to crash and otherwise lose data are due to the fact that you're accessing them. And so if you're not moving the mechanics around, if you're not exercising the firmware to have corruption, then the chance of you getting just random bit rot is actually, I would guess, going to approach the random bit rot on your silicon.
Yeah,
I'd encourage you to take a closer look at that.
Yeah, definitely. I think there would also be a balancing point because depending on the value of this data, you're going to want to go through and do integrity checking processes on it. So at what point are you hitting it too often, so you might be incurring extra mechanical wear? That's something we've talked about. We aren't sure where that sweet spot is, though.
Yeah.
If no one else has a question. Another thing I'd encourage, based on what we've seen in our lab, is looking at, you know, it appears that one of the predominant failure mechanisms of today's SSDs is really non-silicon based. In other words, you have to make a reliable system, one where, you know, the solder remains intact and all sorts of things like that. There's unfortunately some vendors in the field that don't come from a history of making reliable, you know, decade lifespan or more devices. So I do wonder, when you start looking at lifetimes longer than that, how even the best devices would do.
Yeah, taking a holistic approach is definitely something that needs to be done when we're dealing with these archival systems.
I guess my question is a little bit different. Not from the point of the
device becoming broken by sitting on the shelf for 5 or 10 years or anything, but more from the point, is there still going to be hardware that has a proper interface to read it?
That is an excellent question. Some of the networking interfaces out there have been very, very stable for a long period of time. Admittedly, this requires speculation, but at some point, we kind of do have to throw our hands up and just say, here's our best shot. We think this will be around 5 to 10 years from now. If not, we lost the game.
Yes, I'll ask the last question. What kind of cost analysis you did? Like, I imagine that if you want to sell that technique, it should be cheaper or at least similar. And what kind of media you looked at?
We did, not shown here, is basically very, very qualitative at this point, where I was leery of throwing around too many numbers just because we're guesstimating based on retail prices. And what makes it more difficult is the fact that management is such a huge factor in running these systems. It was where we looked at, we compared to Amazon S3, and we found using a system built of nodes, at least in terms of acquisition cost, we were competitive against S3 across the board after if we have a 3-year device lifetime. But that's not accounting for all the management and infrastructure costs, which are much, much more difficult to analyze.
Okay, thank you. One more question.
This is Phil from EMC. So I think one question is, what is the retention period for archive that you're considering? It's one thing to think of 5 years or 10 years. Some people even think about 100 years in certain library situations. I think you were partnering with some library groups. And I've even heard it argued that printing out your documents and storing them in a warehouse would be long-term cheaper than keeping them on some sort of digital media, though obviously harder to search. So I think in your research, you may want to consider multiple granularities of time and how the solutions change.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you.
Okay, let's thank the speaker. Thank you. So our second speaker, Greg Genger, will talk about principles of operation for shingled disk devices.
So how many people have heard of shingled disks, shingled recording? So maybe a third or half, cool. I'm going to talk about what shingled recording is in a little bit and some of the directions we see needing to happen in order to deal with them. So let's start with what shingled writing is. So shingled writing is this notion that instead of writing a track of data and having a gap on either side of it, what you do is you write a track of data, and you write the next track of data partially over the top of it. You write the next track of data partially over the top of it. And the next track of data partially over the top of it, kind of like a shingled roof, right? And this is a picture that we got from some of the magnetic folks working on this. And they tell us it's happening. That is, we're going to have this a couple of generations of disks from now. So we have to be aware of it coming. The consequence of this, if you sort of think about what it means to be writing over the top of the previous thing, is that you can't go back and write the thing underneath it without destroying the thing on top of it. Right? You can only write in the forward direction. And relative to the disk drives we've been building systems out of, that's a non-trivial change. Right? So why are they doing it? They're doing it for density. The idea is that the part that's not overlapping is significantly smaller than a non-overlap track plus the gap on either side of it, right? So they can pack stuff in a lot more densely. They talk about in the early uses of the early generations of shingled recording, they won't give us exact numbers. I think they're still figuring out what the exact numbers are, but something on the order of 1.5 to 2.5 more density out of doing this, so that's why they're doing it. They can mix shingled and non-shingled. That is, they can have a single disk that does both, and you can have part of the space do the shingling thing and part of the space not shingled. So you can have a region where you do your random I/O stuff and a region where you don't. And you pay for that in capacity, but what you get back is the ability to do you know, what we've always done with our disk storage. And you can break up the shingled space with gaps. So you can have a range of shingles and then a gap on either side of it, right? Let's call that a band because that's what they're calling it. And that allows you to overwrite whole bands, right? Because you can start over again and shingle the whole thing, right? Without affecting other bands, right? So you can break up the space in that way and pay a fairly small capacity cost in order to get units that are individually overwritable instead of having the whole thing be overwritable just as a single unit, right? So those are some of the organizational setup things that we're going to be aware of that may be happening under the covers, right? So as you listen to me talk about that, you should be thinking, well, one way we can handle this is exactly how we handled a similar issue with Flash. Flash has the characteristic that you can write data once, but if you want to write it again, you have to clear a big region, much bigger than the individual writes, as a unit, right? And you can read anywhere, and that's true of the shingling as well, but if you want to overwrite, you have to overwrite a big unit, right? You have to clear the big unit in order to do it. And you could do this with a shingling device. You could take the shingling disk drive, right, the disk drive that does the shingling thing, that breaks it up into bands, like we were talking about, and use the exact same code. In fact, the disk guys could just go and hire the people from the Flash companies, or buy a Flash company and use the code from the firmware of the Flash device and plug it in, and if they had enough RAM to buffer all of the mapping tables, it would work, right? But it's gonna really hurt when you run into the clean, right? So with a Flash device, it hurts. With this, it's going to hurt, because you're talking about bands that need to be way bigger than the relative size of an individual writable unit in Flash, and then the size that you have to erase, like 1,000 times bigger on these disk devices. Bands are going to be something like 256 meg, 512 meg, right? And that'll be your unit that you have to erase. And when you do cleaning on that, right, in order to do hidden cleaning in Flash devices, you have to read it still alive, right? So read a little bit here, read a little bit here, read a little bit here, read a little bit here. And in a Flash device, that's all really fast. The reads are very fast. In a disk drive, we know a bunch of random reads in order to capture the still alive stuff and write it somewhere else, not really fast, right? So if we do this like we did with Flash and try to completely hide it behind an interface, it's not going to hurt a little bit like it hurts with Flash. It's going to hurt a lot, like a huge amount, right? So that may not be the right answer. And by the way, in addition to hurting from a performance standpoint, the mapping table approach that Flash uses, right? Think about the size, the amount of RAM you would need for the mapping tables for an entire disk drive, especially one that was designed specifically for to have very high capacity, right? Because that's where you want this type of a technology. That's probably a cost we don't want to deal with. So we think that we as a community need to explore non-transparent interfaces for these shingled recording things. We're going to have to expose at least some aspects of what's going on down there and then let the software that's above deal with it. Okay? So part of this is going to be trying to define an interface that works for both sides of that interface, where you expose enough that the operating system and the system software and the applications can work around it, but works nicely for the device as well. So clearly some notion of bands is going to have to be exposed. Probably some non-shingled regions are going to have to be a part of this. The trim command, for those of you that are familiar with it, that's introduced to be able to tell a Flash device that certain blocks are no longer alive so that it doesn't have to deal with cleaning them, that's going to have to be a part of it. And then we're going to have to modify the systems above to cope with it. And some things are going to be easy to modify if we run a log structured file system above. Here comes the log structured file system again. If we run a log structured file system above and we match the segment size to the band size, it just happens for free, much like with the Flash devices. If we do a translation layer approach in the host instead of on the device, maybe that's the way we get around the RAM cost of doing the translation layer. Because they're not going to want to stick that kind of RAM in disk drives. The margins that they have for profit are already way too tiny to have that be a real option. We can use very, very large blocks at the operating system layer, not for everything, but there are a number of large data applications for which very large blocks are perfectly fine. HDFS uses a chunk size of 64 megabytes. The kinds of killer apps that this is going to be useful for beyond HDFS kinds of things, DVRs, be perfectly happy using a very large block size, backup devices, checkpoint devices, right? There's a lot of things actually that would be okay just using a gigantic block size if you tell it what block size is the right one in order to get the right kind of performance out of the device. Yeah. And then there's questions of how is this going to change the way we want to do the storage hierarchy, right? If we're going to take our disk drives and make them have characteristics that, if we're not adapting to them, that look like tape, right? How are we going to need to change the flash or NVM or whatever layers in order to accommodate that for us, right? Okay, so this is a short talk. I'm not going to tell you any of the answers to any of that. Shingled recording is this interesting thing that's going to happen to us. It's on us, the storage systems group folks, to figure out what to do about that. There's a broad range of open questions centered around how to deal with it, because the answer of just stick a translation layer in there inside of the storage device itself is probably economically and usability-wise not an answer that's practical. So what are the right interfaces to expose aspects of the shingling stuff? What are the right ways to exploit the positives of this shingled recording and to dodge the downsides? And how are we going to want to divide the control among the various components? What stuff do we go ahead and ask the firmware to do for us, and then what stuff do we do at the higher levels of software, right? So welcome to the party.
Yes, I start first question. So if you say that's something which is going to happen, right? Uh-huh. So does it mean that now we are going always explicitly trade off performance for capacity, or it's something that we're now giving up, that we're not going to have good performance for disk, so at least we get as much capacity as we need?
So first of all, when I say it's going to happen, let's be clear, I'm told that it's going to happen by the people that can tell me that it's going to happen. I don't know anything, right? We have the option of just not buying devices to do this. We could just decide that the next factor of two of capacity is not something we care about, so we're going to skip it. But I don't think that's really going to happen, right? So when I say it's going to happen, I mean if we want the capacity, if we want the next set of capacity increments, we're going to have to live with this, right? That's going to come with it. But the fact that you can mix the shingling and the non-shingling means you can buy a device and just not use any of the shingling. Right, you could do that, and it is a performance versus, it's a performance for certain kinds of workload versus capacity, right?
Thank you.
All right, so I have a comment, and my name is, by the way, Yujip Won from Panyang University. It looks that the problem seems to be very similar to selecting a victim in SSD. I mean, for erase and garbage collection, you have to select victims to which block to clean up and stuff like that. And so we can slightly modify that problem and apply the sick time and rotational delay aspect of hard disk drive, and we can nicely reformulate the problem. But more importantly, the question is that, is it gonna be a competitor to SSD, or do you think it's gonna beat the SSD storage densities in the future, or what's the point or as the positions in the industry about this technology?
I'm not wearing my badge, but my badge says university on it too, so I don't know what the position of the industry is. I'll tell you my opinion on this. I don't think either SSD is going to replace disk at this point, or disk is going to blow out any of the solid state storage devices. I think we're going to have systems of both, right? And for the big capacity stuff, solid-state devices are still not economically in the same regime as rotating magnetic storage is. There may come a time that happens. I mean, we've certainly had, I've been around long enough, I've seen that projected two or three times, and I know other people in the audience have seen it projected more times than that. But I'm not aware of it being projected as happening soon. So I think we're going to have both.
All right. Thank you.
Jeff Kenning, Harvey Mudd College. So this morning I was arguing for writing special file systems for flash drives. And now you're telling me, oh, well, we're also going to have to write a special file system for this really baroque and weird design. And, of course, we've got more strange things coming down the pipe, which are going to have weird characteristics of their own that we don't even know what they are yet. Is there any hope for getting out of this and getting, you know, do you think there's ever going to be a time when we can do an abstraction properly and get this stuff back down in the device, hidden where it ought to be?
So I think what you're asking is, so first of all, I know that you can't possibly be sad about the fact that we get to keep writing new cool file systems, right? I know you too well. But setting that aside, you know, we could stick an abstraction and hide all this stuff on the device. The question isn't, are we ever going to be able to? The question is it ever going to be the right thing to do to hide all this stuff behind a device interface? And there's enough difference, for example, between a PCM-based storage device, and a flash-based storage device, and a normal disk-based storage device before you even do this, that it's not clear to me that all of that stuff ought to be behind the exact same interface. So we could, but I'm not sure it'll ever be a good idea if we're going to have a lot of different kinds of storage devices. Maybe yes, maybe no, but I'm not convinced of it.
Peter Desnoyers. First, an observation, which is, in fact, a lot of cheaper SSDs gang together a whole bunch of blocks so that, in fact, you may have 32 meg blocks getting erased at once. What I'm wondering is how much of what you're talking about is calls for new interfaces as opposed to sort of, you know, like I know Jiri Schindler has talked about the implicit performance contract across the interface, that you've got a block interface, but everyone assumes that it behaves like a naive disk mapping. Now, we've got these systems now that behave differently than that. This is a little bit different from a flash device, in particular because it has the disk's, you know, characteristic that it's position independent. You don't have these hard block boundaries that you have. You know, any block boundaries are arbitrary, but you still have this same sort of, you know, overwrite erase behavior. So, do you have any thoughts on whether that can be, you know, like everything else, funneled into the same logical block address space, or really does require something new?
Yeah, so you can absolutely not have to change the interface as long as you're okay with terrible performance if you don't understand that what's going on down there is not the simple block interface and almost always not use it that way. So, for example, you could have the block interface, and any time you get a single block write, what it does is it reads the whole band, changes the one block, and writes the whole band back. And I'm not kidding. We've thought about that as a base. And then what you do is you change the software above to understand where the band boundaries are, and any time it can, don't do that. Send a write for the whole band, or a write that starts at a beginning of band and works its way down and says, I'm doing that, right? I have trimmed the whole band. It's all empty. Right, and that's a way you could avoid having to change everything. So other things that are unchanged will continue to work correctly, as long as correct doesn't have a performance component to it. Right.
Okay, because we already have an interface which, if you don't use it correctly, has horrible performance. It's been so ingrained in us that you need to access sequentially that you don't even think about it. Whereas if you use
traditional we're just talking about degrees of horrible here, right?
That's so true, it's worse.
So yes, you have horrible performance if you do random I/O, but you don't get the performance of as though you read 512 megabytes and wrote 512 megabytes every time you do a random 512 byte write, right? So it's not that bad. We'll have a new definition of what horrible is if we use it that way, I guess is what I would say.
Okay. One last quick question, please.
Right, so this is actually a comment. So my name is Albert Chen, I'm from Western Digital, so I cannot confirm nor deny SMR is coming or not. But if it is coming, we did talk about strategies that you mentioned. However, for the short term, for adoption of SMR technology, we will need a lot of file system support, for example, from NTFS, from different file systems. However, So for the short term, we would like the file system to be SMR aware to, for example, to configure the disk to have different bands to know what type of file you should store in those bands. However, in the future, for innovation in the device, in the storage device, we could potentially have additional tiering of flash of different magnetic recording zones. We would like the file system potentially to have hints sent down. So, for example, today there's trim, as you mentioned, but there's 31 more bits that's available in the command that we could use. So, that's just my comment.
Yeah, and I agree with the sort of hidden part of what you said, which is that we want the interface that's exposing some of what's going on here to be sort of exposing as little detail as is necessary and as in a high level and abstract a way as possible to allow the innovation to happen underneath while at the same time allowing the stuff above to react appropriately, right? And it's always a fun design kind of a thing to come up with that interface, right?
Okay, thank you.
Stay connected.
So note to self for next time, if there's a panel, put a break before it. Okay, so while we're getting settled in, I'd like to introduce the panel. So let me start with the moderator. So I have the privilege of having worked with Carl and having had him as a mentor for several years. Carl has been conducting research in the area of resource management for more than 2 decades. So it's very apropos that we've managed to get him to moderate a session about effectively storage resource management. For most of the previous decade, he was a principal engineer at VMware, where he was responsible for the core resource management and virtualization technologies, including CPU scheduling, memory management, and distributed resource management. Carl has to his name a whole bunch of industry firsts, including memory ballooning, page sharing, SMP VM co-scheduling, and virtual machine-based NUMA optimizations. And more recently, Carl's also been looking at storage resource management, where he's led some pretty amazing work. Prior to VMware, Carl was a researcher at the DEC Systems Research Center, and Carl has more than 40 issued patents to his name. So with that, I'd like to request Carl to come and introduce the session and lead it. And while Carl's doing that, I'm going to make sure that everybody's mic'd up and all that sort of stuff. So ignore me if you see me up here.
Well, thanks for the nice intro, Irfan. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the last session of the workshop. It's my pleasure to be able to moderate this panel discussion today on the topic of the theory and practice of storage quality of service. And we have a really great distinguished panel of four experts in this area, spanning both academia and industry. And fortunately, they're very opinionated as well, so it should make for some interesting discussion. I personally think that storage QoS is a really fascinating and challenging problem. In my own work, I found storage to be one of the most complex resources to manage, and consequently, it's also one of the least likely that you'll find with storage QoS controls or resource management controls, especially in practice. So in preparation for today, the panelists were asked to think about and try to touch upon a few different themes or topics in their initial presentations. And Some of these include, what do administrators and users really want from storage quality of service? Do they need hard guarantees? Are they looking for SLOs, sort of like the NetApp talk that you saw earlier today proposed? Or are they looking for just predictable performance? You know, what things are really needed? Also, it's really not clear that even if you know what you want, you know how to express it. And this was touched upon in the earlier talk as well. But do you want to describe QoS controls or QoS specifications in terms of things like latency and IOPS, low-level metrics? Or should it be in terms of higher-level application-level metrics like database transactions per second? Or perhaps even some more abstract notion of utility or economic cost? Next, even if you know what you want to do and you can specify it, trying to enforce it is a very difficult proposition. As we all know, there's significant complexity in storage systems. This includes complexity in the devices themselves, multiple layers of components of both hardware and software, caching, tiering, virtualization, multi-tenancy, and so forth. It's a very deep and difficult problem. Also, even if you can affect resource management or quality of service controls, there's this inherent tension between trying to enforce those controls and yet getting aggregate efficiency out of your entire system. And that, I think, has also slowed the adoption of storage QoS. We're also interested in what the impact of technology shifts are. So as we move toward SSDs, flash-based PCM, and other, what effect does that have on our ability to implement storage quality of service? So we're interested in both theoretical results and practical results. In theory, we have academic results that help explain what's possible under a given set of assumptions, but in practice, we need to determine what's really feasible for a concrete, complex, real-world system. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce our first panelist. Each of the panelists will be speaking for about 8 minutes. That should give us enough time to spend most of this session on interactive discussion with you, the audience. And I'd encourage everyone to speak their mind. So our first speaker, panelist, is Ajay Gulati. Ajay is a member of the Distributed Resource Management team at VMware. Over the past 4 years, he's worked on a number of very high-profile projects, such as VMware's DRS product and new features in the area of storage resource management and QoS, and trying to get efficient utilization of I/O resources in a virtualized data center. He's also currently leading VMware's cloud-scale resource management effort. Let's welcome Ajay.
One thing I've seen in, we have seen in last decade is that virtualization has been successful as a technology to consolidate workloads, but one of the key reasons for success has been that along with consolidation, it has been able to provide QoS and isolation, especially CPU and memory resources. VMware has had a very rich set of controls to make sure that you can run 50 VMs on one server and they can still get the CPU and memory requirements that they need. When it comes to storage, again, the same thing appears. On the right-hand side, I'm showing a very typical diagram where a single LUN is shared across multiple hosts. So in a typical case, a LUN may be shared across 30, 40 hosts, and each host may be running a bunch of VMs. And this can be either done using a clustered file system or using NFS. And it turns out that hundreds of virtual disks may be sharing that single device. Now, once you put 100 virtual disks on one device, what you see is this, what we call as I/O blending, that the workload at the disk would pretty much look like a random workload coming from all over the place. And so far, customers have been mostly relying on this hardware-based isolation, which turns out to be very expensive, and we know the cost of storage arrays is one of the key components or the biggest elephant in the room in terms of data store cost that customers have to incur. And I think that we definitely need better storage controls going forward in future. So here is my overall position and my take for looking at the next 5 years. And I feel that in next 5 years, we would have much more pervasive storage QoS controls. And the reason for that is the driving factor, I feel, is going to be the virtualized environments and not the physical environments. And in virtualized environments, customers would ask for more and more per VM controls. These will be in terms of performance, but also in terms of, I don't need backup for this VM, or I need compression for this VM, but not for the other VM. I may not need reliability for certain set of VMs. And in order to provide these controls, I think one of the key technologies that would allow us to build these controls is going to be SSD adoption in the storage arrays. We are already seeing multiple vendors shipping multi-tiered arrays and then work going on in purely SSD-based storage arrays. And I think once we get to that, that would really help us build these controls at per VMDK level. Now, this is what I see as the projection in next 5 years. But let's look at what we have today. The state of the art that, as we know, is that we have existing implementations. For example, Linux has CFQ and deadline-based scheduling. And in research, we have a lot of prototypes built in last decade about which basically do WFQ-based scheduling with some certain storage-specific optimizations. And also, there are approaches that do time-slicing-based. If you look at virtualization-specific areas, there we have in ESX currently SFQ scheduler, and we had another recent approach called Parda that did proportional shares across a cluster of hosts and not within the cluster. Similarly, we had another approach called Bazel that did load balancing across devices, and there was an I/O scheduler called MClock that provided reservations, limit, and share-based control, very similar to what we have for CPU and memory for storage. But what we have seen is that most of these controls ultimately deal with doing some sort of proportional allocation. Or in other words, you're getting a certain amount of IOPS or some performance from the device, and you're trying to do a good job at distributing that performance. But in many cases, that may not be enough to really give meaningful guarantees to the applications. So why is there lack of good controls? It turns out that, one, we don't have good controls in terms of things that customers can easily monitor and measure, for example, in terms of latency and throughput. And existing mechanisms, they do not give any guarantees. They basically rely on the best effort proportional allocation. And some of the reasons I feel for having that kind of behavior is that for disks, we have really struggled in the last 10, 15 years about this fairness and efficiency trade-off, where if you try to be fair, then you may lose a lot of efficiency, and customers have always preferred efficiency more than fairness. So you cannot be implementing a fairness or QoS-based mechanism while sacrificing the efficiency on the storage device. Second, which I think is even bigger reason, is that unit of allocation in case of storage is apparently very complicated. If you look at CPU, the way we sort of distribute CPU, we say we'll give you some amount of megahertz. The reservation is set in terms of megahertz. It's easy to give a VM 100 megahertz, but what we are not guaranteeing is saying your overall instructions being executed would be in certain ratio, or we would guarantee a certain number of instructions that you can execute. In case of storage, we are apparently trying to go that route. We are saying we are not giving you some easy to measure unit. We are trying to allocate throughput or latency, which is sort of dependent on the what workload you run on the device, what device you have, what sort of caching and other architectures you have built into the array, and the unit of allocation gets very complicated and hard to build controls on. Finally, we all know that we get very variable performance from a storage device in terms of latency as well as overall throughput. And there are a lot of papers which have tried to provide guarantees assuming the worst-case behavior. Now, you can build guarantees assuming worst-case behavior, but in practice, customers do not want you to admit two workloads assuming worst-case behavior, whereas in reality, they could admit 20 of them. Clearly, they're not going to be buying your arrays anymore. So how do we bridge this gap? And why do I feel that this will be bridged in future? There are two questions that I think we need to answer. First question, as Carl pointed out, how to define QoS. And this is a very hotly debated topic as how to define. People have introduced multiple metrics like throughput, like megabytes per second, latency. And I feel that one of the simplest way to define this is just go with latency. What I mean by that is just let the customer specify sort of what is the overall latency sensitivity of the application. It could be a range. For example, you can say these applications can deal with less than 10 milliseconds. Some other set of applications can deal with less than 20. And some third set of applications can deal with 50 to 60 milliseconds. And the nice thing that I feel about latency is that if you go with another route, let's say throughput, the problem with throughput is it's possible that a VM or an application is not even asking for that much throughput. And you have to distinguish between was there enough demand or could I not meet the required allocation because of some contention on the device. In case of latency, if I'm promising 10 milliseconds, it doesn't matter what you asked for. And we would give you 10 milliseconds within, obviously, a certain range of IOPS. So I feel one way to do is to define it is to have a latency bound up to a certain load, and the load can be defined in terms of certain IOPS, or there are other ways of defining the load. Second question I think we need to answer is how to meet this latency bound. Obviously, once we have defined something like this, we need to be able to meet that bound. And there, I think the keyword, I think if I ask, can people guess what keyword I'm going to put there, it's a single word. I think we just talked about it in many of the talks. And I think if we have multi-tiered arrays, and we have enough SSD within the array, and we can make sure that the working set fits inside the SSD, I think we already have a lot of research that would allow us to give better guarantees. And okay. And I think that SSD adoption is going to be the key for QoS implementation going in future. And in order to really make it happen, I think we need a combination of QoS-aware SSD placement techniques, not just caching-aware or not just hit rate-aware techniques, and also QoS-aware scheduling techniques on both SSDs and disks. Thank you.
Thanks, Ajay. Our next panelist is Kaladhar Buraganti, and Kaladhar's technical director in the CTO office at NetApp. He previously worked for many years at IBM Almaden Research. He says that he loves to build products, and he's contributed toward building a number of different products, including storage controllers, storage management, and cloud storage repositories. He's been really active in the academic community, serving as an associate editor for several journals and supervising grad students at two different Indian universities.
Okay, hi. So I'll start off with describing what my mental model is. Okay. So what my mental model is with respect to SLO management. So we have three players here. You have the storage vendors at the bottom. You have the storage providers, so that you can think of many cloud providers and service providers for that tier, and storage subscribers. So these are basically application administrators, and storage providers can be also substituted by system administrators. So essentially, the flow is as follows. You have a storage vendor, and they are giving you many, many different types of features in their arrays. So you have caches, you have security features, protection features, performance features, different types of disks, and so on. And they provide all these different options to the storage provider or a system administrator. And today, it's the system administrator's responsibility to figure out how to combine all of these things. And it's not just about performance. It's about performance, protection, availability, security, storage efficiency, all of these things in an integrated manner, and also worrying about cost, what kind of cost they're going to charge for that. So it's a pretty hard responsibility for a storage provider. And once the storage provider combines all these different types of technologies, they can then offer services. So they can basically say, I'm going to offer you gold class of service, I'm going to offer you silver and bronze, and each of these service types will have different characteristics with respect to performance, protection, et cetera. And then the storage subscribers come and say, I want so much capacity of gold. I want so much capacity of silver and so on. So this is the current today. This is the mental model. So there are products out there today which can give you this functionality. However, I feel that this is fundamentally, there are many problems with this, and I'm going to get why even this is hard for the providers. So why SLO management? So storage subscribers, really all they want is a way to specify their requirements. And usually they don't want to specify the requirements in terms of latency, RTO, RPO, you know, number of nines, and so on. What they really want to specify their requirements is in terms of their application requirements. How many mailboxes of Exchange, of what type of user, of, you know, heavy user, light user, and so on. What type of database transactions, really OLTP, high transactions, low transactions, and so on. So they would ideally like to specify the requirements in an application domain specific way. And they also would like to measure the SLOs. So are they really getting what they're asking for? So they need a way to measure that. What do storage providers want? They want to have the flexibility to bring in new technology. Today, it's SSDs. Previously, it was fiber channel disk. Before that, you know, other types of disk technologies, right? Going forward, if you have phase change memory-based storage devices, so be it. So they would like an abstraction layer so that they can, underneath the covers, change the technologies, but still offer a certain level of service to their subscribers. So that is one thing they would like to have. Second thing they would like to have is to reduce the OPEX cost. When I say operational expenses cost, there are many different things there. So for example, today, in the past, in most private data centers, you could run your systems at, let's say, 20 or 30% utilization and get away with it. But in the provider world, if you can push that barrier from 20 or 30% to, let's say, 50 or 60%, that's money in the bank for the provider. So they need to figure out how to co-locate applications of various types on the same shared infrastructure. So we are moving away really from a siloed world to a shared infrastructure world. And similarly, power costs, management costs. So for example, instead of one administrator managing very few resources, they want to scale the number of resources that a single administrator can manage. So that requires a lot of automation. So there are three problems with the current SLO-based approaches. First, specifying SLOs is hard. Second, to do any type of management, you need to have models. So people have worked on creating black box and white box models in the past. However, there's no single modeling technology that we can really say today that is solving the problem. Third, uncoordinated management across different layers. So you heard the previous speaker. He's from VMware. So they are working on how to manage storage at their layer. We are, as a storage company, looking at how to manage storage at our layer. There are orchestration tools from many companies. They're also trying to figure out how to coordinate the management. Applications are also trying to figure out how to do management. So there is a need for all these different players to figure out how to play together. So I'm not going to go into the details. I'll quickly run. We don't want, many of the tools today are exposing their functionalities as, oh, I want SATA disks or fiber channel disks or SSDs. We don't want to expose storage properties in technology-dependent ways. We want to expose them in terms of technology-independent ways, like performance should be with respect to latency, throughput, conformance window, predictability of performance in the conformance window, protection, availability as, you know, RTO, RPO. But what we realized is that even that is hard. Like, very few administrators are capable of even giving you what kind of latency they would like and what kind of RTO and RPO they would like. So even that level of specification we feel is not the right abstraction. It's good for the tools, underlying management tools, to have that, because now they can then track it and actually manage. But usability of those levels of abstraction, I don't think is right. Prior research. So utility specification work by, I think the authors are here, John and Greg, is useful because it's trying to, there are many dimensions in SLOs. It's not just about performance. It's about performance, protection, et cetera. So they're trying to figure out how to bring all these different dimensions together under the same umbrella. The HP, you know, Rome SLO specification mechanism. And there's some work on how to map different applications to the underlying storage tiers. But the insight, the key insight that we have is that we need to basically, instead of taking these SLO requirements at a higher level and trying to figure out what's the best storage configuration you need to map it to, instead of top-down approach, we want to take a bottom-up approach. So essentially what we want to do is that just like when you go in the airplane, you say you're going business class, first class, or economy class, for various applications, we want to basically package qualified solutions, not just with respect to performance. Performance, we feel, is just one of the dimensions. With respect to all of these dimensions, and it's very hard to do it through automation, so we feel that we have to make the problem more tractable. So we want to specify these qualified solutions. And then the second thing also I think we need is, as Ajay already pointed out, I think flash makes a big difference. Previously, what would happen, you would provision, thinking that this is the SLO I would like to have, you would provision that on one type of siloed storage, and if you got it wrong, you have to migrate all the data somewhere else. Going forward, I think what will happen, you will have hybrid systems where you'll have a combination of flash, disk. So even if you have the wrong SLO, the overhead of correcting that is not that high, because you can very quickly say, I'm going to give you more flash and I'm going to take away flash from you. Automation research, it's not even close. I think a lot of work has to be done, and coming up with black box or white box models is too hard. So basically, we have to make this problem also tractable. So qualified solutions helps in this regard, because now you're going to say, I'm going to qualify this solution for these three types of workloads. Then we know that these three workloads, interference between them, we need to worry about. So qualification, again, here I think is very important. Last thing, standards. I think for all these different layers to really operate together, management tool interaction, I think we have to worry about standards. So different CDMI standard, the NFS standard, even T10 standards, all of them have to start thinking about how you can specify SLO abstractions in these standards, and already CDMI is doing that, and NFS, there is an effort. So from going forward, I think you will see a lot of effort by various companies in pushing SLO notions into the various storage access standards. So as I mentioned, QSLOs is what we are pushing for. And you heard that in the previous talk. So instead of giving various combination of technologies, you give a package of technologies to the storage providers, which has been qualified. You know how to manage because you have the models that can manage them. And then it makes providers' life very easy. And then the subscribers choose what type of service they want. And there are ways to measure that because you have the SLOs. And these services, you want to abstract them in the application domain, at application domain level, so that it's usable for the subscribers. Thank you.
Okay, our next panelist is Ed Lee. Ed is an architect at Tintri, which is a startup pioneering VMware storage for virtual machines. And previously, Ed was the technical director at Data Domain, and also he was a member of the original Berkeley RAID team. Ed's authored many papers on storage systems, including RAID, Petal, and Frangipani. Thanks, Ed.
Thanks, Carl. Hi. So I'm currently at a company called Tintri. We build storage systems specifically designed for virtual machines. So some of the positions I'll present is actually kind of related to virtual machines in various ways. So what is storage QoS? To kind of define it operationally, especially from the perspective of a system administrator, I'll say it's the goal is to avoid user complaints without spending a lot of money or time, right? Today, what do you feel is the most commonly applied storage quality of service technique today? Anyone have a thought? Yes? Exactly, over-provisioning. And what was the most commonly applied quality of service technique for servers before server virtualization, over provisioning, right? And over provisioning is expensive, but it works. And it turns out today, because of the state of things, it is the cheapest way to solve your quality of service problem. It's cheaper to over provision than to spend a lot of your time figuring out where the performance problem is and figuring out how to solve that performance problem. All right. And why is that case? Well, in some cases, because the latest technologies or tools, you know, are not readily available. So there's a lot of reasons why that's the case, and you know, some of the panelists have already touched upon that. Now, in reading a lot of quality of service papers, I did not read a single paper which recommended over-provisioning as the preferred way to solve your storage quality of service problems. Right. If you know of such papers, please send me a link. I would be interested in reading them. So server virtualization has come a long way in terms of addressing quality of service issues. And a lot of users and actual customers have gotten a lot of benefit from that. They've been able to greatly reduce the cost of servers. But the same thing has not quite happened with storage quality of service yet. Another thing I point out here is kind of, you know, we want to avoid user complaints, which basically means that we are meeting their needs, right? And, you know, when do users complain? What do they notice? Generally, they complain about, you know, latency-sensitive applications, right? Those are the hardest applications for which you can meet quality of service constraints. Because if something is just batch-oriented or throughput-oriented, you just have to make sure you have the right total number of IOPS and so forth. But when something is latency sensitive, even if you've got a ton of IOPS in the back end, if everyone happens to, you know, log in at the same time or something, someone is going to notice something that's slower. And usually, I'm not going to notice that my friend Bill's machine is running 20% faster. Right? I may not even know about that. But if today, my build takes 3 minutes, and yesterday it took 2 minutes, I'm going to notice that. And I'm going to ask, well, why did my build go slower today? So I think a big part of the problem also is kind of consistency. Consistency of the performance on a day-to-day, kind of week-to-week basis. And you know, consistency implies a certain level of fairness, but it's kind of distinct from fairness. It's kind of a bigger, in a higher level, a bigger picture problem, I think. Now, no matter what quality of service system you have, even if it's the greatest technology, you know, everything's working fine, you're going to have problems because someone misspecified the quality of service specifications or some need in the system changed. And so in a well-designed system, you're going to spend a lot of time addressing exceptions, basically. So you know, you also need good mechanisms to analyze and debug quality of service problems. And I think that should actually be treated and considered as a part of the quality of service area. It shouldn't be considered something separate you do as an afterthought. Okay, so let's move on to the next. So there's also been recently several technological improvements which brings up certain challenges and opportunities for QoS for storage. One notable one is SSDs. Until the advent of SSDs, way of thinking of performance has been heavily constrained by optimizing access to spindles, right? SSDs kind of opens up that whole area. And now, with SSDs, IOPS are very cheap, but gigabytes is very expensive. So suddenly, the most expensive or precious performance resource in your system has become SSD capacity, right? It's not IOPS anymore, it's SSD capacity. Because if you cannot get your application to fit in an SSD at a reasonable price, it doesn't matter how many IOPS that SSD can provide, right? And today, in fact, you can buy a single SSD that provides 160,000 IOPS. So you have 10 of those, you've got over 1 million IOPS. What are you going to do with all of that? But if it's too expensive to fit your application in it, it doesn't really help you, right? As a result, people have been building hybrid SSD and hard disk storage systems in order to mitigate some of the high costs of SSD. This means, though, that you introduce another metric, which is kind of the SSD hit rate. So you know, up to now, we've been very concerned about things like the latency and throughput of the storage system. But now we're entering an era where the primary metric is the SSD hit rate. If your I/O hits an SSD, you're going to get really good performance and latency. If it misses, then you're going to get really bad performance, you know, 10 times worse or even more, right? And you're going to end up queuing delays because you're queued behind the disk, behind other slow requests. The third challenge is kind of the popularity or advent or continuing trend toward large-scale virtualized computer systems. And this is not so much a problem as an opportunity, I would say. Being able to easily move VMs between both compute nodes and storage nodes provides you know, enormous new opportunity, which wasn't there before. And it's an opportunity that properly designed quality of service systems could tremendously kind of improve the usability and service you can get from these systems. Okay, so to quickly go through some of the specific problems. But today, as other panelists have also commented, server and storage virtualization software, and in general, you know, components of your computing system are built by different sets of vendors. For example, you know, virtualization software is built by vendors like VMware, Microsoft, Citrix, Red Hat, storage by companies like NetApp, EMC, Tintri. Left on their own, they're all going to go off and design their own quality of service you know, techniques and systems, right? I often like to use a highway system as an example for quality of service mechanisms because something that everyone is aware of. But you know that today on freeways, you have metering lights and carpool lanes, and you need both of them to work properly. Both are implemented at different levels of the system. So, you know, there are quality of service problems which you cannot address at any single level of the system, right? Requires coordination among different components. So, you know, a lot of work needs to be done in terms of defining what these mechanisms should be, you know, what problems are best addressed at what layer, and what information should be shared across these systems. All right. A second problem, in large-scale systems, you have many users, many components. So that means that no matter how well it's designed, there's always going to be exceptions and non-optimal results. And so there needs to be ways of quickly analyzing and fixing these problems. And if you look at the whole system, there are many things you can do to fix a problem. It's not just a matter of addressing you know, the amount of resources you allocate to here or there. In some cases, you have to buy more resources. In some cases, you want to constrain you know, certain misbehaving applications. So you know, quickly being able to analyze and fix these problems, I think, should also be considered a part of the intrinsic quality of service problem, right? And then finally, you know, no matter how good the quality of service technology, if your system is not designed rationally, it's not going to work well, right? You know, if the underlying pipes and infrastructure is contorted and, you know, just doesn't, you know, work well, there's nothing you can do about it. So I think another gap that we can consider is, well, what are good ways of designing systems so that they are amenable to good, you know, quality of service techniques, or they will operate, you know, in a larger system with other components with good quality of service guarantees. Okay. That's it. Thank you. Thank you, Carl.
Greg. And our last panelist today is Greg Ganger. Greg is the Jatras Professor of Electrical and Computer Engineering at Carnegie Mellon University. Greg is also the director of CMU's Parallel Data Lab, or PDL, which is CMU's research center focused on storage systems and large-scale infrastructure.
All right, cool. Yeah. So, I don't know, I'm not going to have this big, long, serious talk exactly like the other guys did, I guess. You know, I got told that the topic we were addressing was the gap between theory and practice. And as somebody who's apparently practice has to do with, you know, whether or not you make products. So as somebody who apparently represents the theory side of this little game, which would make the other faculty at Carnegie Mellon guffaw. I'm going to talk about the gap that I see. And the first question I wonder when I got asked this question is the word gap just it doesn't feel like it's sufficiently strong to represent what's going on here, right? I tried to think about what the right word was, but it really feels like a picture is the right way to express it, right? So this is one of the nice pictures from Google Images for the Grand Canyon. This one I really like because you can see a rainbow out there, and you know maybe there's some hope, right? So we don't have to jump. So why is there this gigantic gap actually between what's been a lot of work in trying to do storage QoS, and I've been involved in some of it too, and a lot of the people up here have, and the ability to actually do it. There's actually, and we've heard bits and pieces of this, but there's gigantic reasons why we're so far away from actually being able to do this. And we'll have some fun arguing with each other about some of the solutions that got thrown out here, because I'm not sure I bought any of them, including any ideas that I have on it. So let's start with what the theory says that you do if you want to solve the storage QoS problem, right? You start with this clear definition of what it is you're trying to achieve, some service level objectives, right? We'll just stick with the performance thing for a little bit because, the mixing all of them is hard, but let's just stick with the performance one, right? No way, not even close. Human beings suck at this, right? And we are no exception to that as the experts in storage systems. We are awful at expressing what it is that we need in terms of performance from a system, right? There's few exceptions to that that exist, but not a lot. And where they exist, usually the way we specify things are very loose, right? So we can guess, or we can say things like, well, it'd be nice if everything happened within 100 milliseconds or something like that. And by the way, we're inherently going to be worse at this because we're trying to specify what you need for storage QoS at a level that is not at the level that people are thinking about QoS, right? People that are thinking about QoS care about applications. We have to figure out what that means for us behind the scenes, right? They don't care about us at all. They don't, right? That makes it really awkward because it means we're doing things very loose, right? Right off the bat. So if you have a very loose goal, on one side you can feel good because you're not going to miss it, but on the other side, you have a very loose goal, right? So one idea that I'll throw out so that other people can pick on one of my ideas while I'm picking on theirs. This idea that we kicked around for a long time, and John was one of the people, John Strunk, who got mentioned before, is to try to elicit performance goals based on complaints, because this is how it works in the real world. So Ed brought up one half of it, right? You over-provision. This is what real sysadmins do to solve problems, right? They don't ever want to hear from you as a user, so they put in more than they think that you need, as little more as they think they can get away with, but more than they think that you need, and then if you complain about it, they'll add more. And that's how QoS happens in the real world now, right? Well, there's a lesson in that we ought to learn. Maybe that is, in fact, how you learn what the demand is. You do something that you think is a little bit more than is needed. You make a guess. And then you use complaints to zero in on the target, right? Okay, so here's the second one. Let's just say that we could get a spec of what's wanted, for argument's sake, right? So then the next thing that theory says is what you do is you decide how many workloads you can fit on the system by understanding the demand that those workloads put on the system. And you'll admit just as many as you can because that's how you get a utilization of your system and no more, right? So right off the bat, you have assumed that there is some form of stability in terms of the demand that a workload puts on the system and that's predictable. Not even close. Right, there exist workloads for which it is true there is some amount of stability. Usually you have to put a pretty long window on the range of things that you're amortizing over to feel like you're getting that stability. But in practice, workloads vary wildly, right? And they vary wildly not just in intensity. It's not just they have on-off periods or sometimes it's heavy and sometimes it's light. They vary in the characteristics. Sometimes it's sequential and sometimes it's random. And if we've got disk drives under there, the difference between those two things is 100x in terms of how much of the resource you need to achieve a performance metric like bandwidth or IOs per second, right? So the consequence of that is that not only don't we have a target, but we can't predict how much of the resource it would take to hit that target. And the temptation always is to use what was the last period and say that that's going to work for predicting for the next period. But they vary all over the place, right? So the last period, maybe it'll be a good guess, maybe it won't be a good guess. And it won't always be a good guess, right? That's what the varying wildly means. So again, soft guarantees. Now, so not just a soft target, but now a soft aim at the target, right? And since other people have said some of these things, I figured I'd throw a couple of graphs. Here's an example graph of the amount of bandwidth you can get within a window of time applying the given workload to a simple storage device, right? And all I want you to get out of there is it's all over the place. And it has nothing to do with the I/O per second rate. It has to do with the locality within the workload, all over the place. So the amount of device that it takes to achieve a given bandwidth varies wildly. In this example workload, happens to be image rendering. This is what happens if you don't smooth it over reasonably long periods, right? Much worse variability. Okay, so here's the third one. Even if we had a good target and we could count on the workload being stable, the devices aren't stable, right? So the theory says the device, a given device, applied with a given workload applied to it, will give you a given performance. That is, the amount of a device, the fraction of a device you need to achieve a given performance, given a workload and the device, is repeatable. No, that's not how it works. Most of the devices that we use have the characteristic that there's all kinds of weird stuff that they do that makes them not be repeatable in terms of the performance you get. A lot of them used to be, but most of them aren't anymore. So in disk drives, every once in a while, you'll get a request that takes hundreds of milliseconds. And it's not because there's something wrong with the disk. It's because the disk head wasn't able to get what it was trying to get that time with the signal processing, because they run so close to the edge in terms of density. It wasn't able to get it that time around, so it has to wait to rotate around. And maybe it has to try several times, right? And then maybe it has to remap because that one sector is no longer usable. There's interference between workloads that's been talked about. That one we could address technically by doing the right kind of performance insulation. There's internal maintenance on these devices. Any kind of complicated storage device, and by complicated I mean, say, a single disk drive or a single SSD for those of you hoping that the SSD is going to solve this problem for us, right? There's all kinds of internal maintenance that goes on. We know that SSDs are doing remapping inside and then doing cleaning to erase those segments so that it can write again, right? Well, that stuff's happening in the background. And if it happens to be happening at the same time you're trying to get your work done at your predictable performance levels, your performance level is no longer predictable, right? And just for fun, you can no longer buy two devices that are the same. We used to be able to buy two disk drives that were the same. You can't do that anymore. Okay, so you can't take the predictions from one and use it on another as well, is a consequence of that. So a consequence there is that not only don't we have a target, and you can't count on the workload being stable, even if you could, you can't count on the device behaving the same way over time. You have to count on that being wildly variable as well, right? So that's pretty scary. I don't know if you can see that. Here's some examples of disk variation, and you can see some of the numbers way up. And none of this has to do with queuing. It all has to do with how long it takes for the disk to answer. And the fact that some of the things are in the many tens of milliseconds is pretty scary. In fact, sometimes you'll get hundreds of milliseconds. Right? And just a normal disk, that's perfectly fine. All right. I don't know why that was in there twice. Okay, so I said that there was a rainbow out there, right? So I should talk about that, because otherwise it's just a long, depressing diatribe, which maybe it is anyway. So here's some good news. Nobody's expecting us, right, other than us, nobody's actually expecting us to get this perfect, right? Nobody gets perfect now. They're not even close. They do what Ed's talking about. They over-provision, and then they hope they don't get complaints, and if they do, they react to it, right? Well, that's a pretty low bar, and it might be one we could hit, right, or get over the top of. So that's a bit of good news. There is a lot of history for us to learn from in terms of how things work before we try to do storage QoS as a part of the system as opposed to outside the system. We can learn from how real IT groups do tiers of service. You know, they don't do these complicated SLO things inside of most IT organizations. They have one tier, another tier, and a third tier, or something like that, and everything gets classified into one of those things, and it works for them, right? Yeah, the complaint idea, maybe it works. Certainly, reactive fixing is how stuff works in the real world. If something isn't good enough, you fix it, and as long as you fix it quick enough and the complaints come in slow enough, you keep your job and you're happy, right? The metaphor that we've played with in the past when looking at this was looking at human organizations as a metaphor for how to do automated systems, right? Because if that's what we're trying to replace, then the lessons out of what things worked there are things that we ought to be able to borrow. And the thing that we should be trying to do rather than somehow magically replace what's being done now with solutions to problems that maybe are inherently not solvable, like how to get human beings to tell us what performance targets to hit, is instead to find ways to tighten the loop. That is, instead of this loop process where a human being decides how much to over-provision by and then reacts to a complaint specified to their department by whatever user or application group department makes the complaint, if the system can automatically do the refinement inside, we can get a lot closer to hitting our targets than if we sort of start from the beginning, expect to have perfect SLOs and perfect device models and perfect stability out of workloads. Done.
Well, that was indeed rather depressing. We took a little bit longer than I was hoping for the initial comments and presentations, but I'd really like to encourage folks to come up to the microphones now and ask some questions.
I'm assuming that we would like to converge in this discussion, and my question is based on that assumption. So. Ajay, in your world, it seems like latency is sufficient. And to me, that seems to make a lot of sense, barring some applications. But I'd also like to hear from the other panelists as to what they think about that take. Is latency sufficient to express QoS guarantees?
I think part of it is not so much what is sufficient, because a lot of these metrics would be sufficient, but what is the most natural or best way for kind of people to specify these constraints? And if you use latencies, then you would probably optimize your system in different ways than others. So for some applications, latency is absolutely the most critical metric. Others, you might want to think of it more in terms of throughput or burst performance or minimizing the worst case performance. So it really is all kind of application specific, and that's why I think, as Greg was saying, why this problem is so hard to nail.
Right. So I'm sort of looking latency as the lowest level guarantee, but QoS can be expressed differently by the application, and there could be some kind of translation in between that would convert from this high level specification, such as what Kalather was talking about, into a latency specification. But it seems like you're arguing, Ed, that that's not always possible.
Yeah. Well, some metrics are directly convertible. Like, depending on the system, latency can be converted directly to throughput constraints. Could be directly converted to other constraints. If these are linear metrics, then they're convertible with respect to each other. But then in some workloads, you don't actually care about linear metrics. You may want to minimize the worst case performance, for example.
Yeah, or the variation.
Yeah, or the variation.
Yeah. Thanks.
Nice try.
I have, this is Yujip Wan from Hanyang University. I have a question and comment first.
QoS guarantee has been around for decades, and latency and bandwidth and variability, latency guarantee and bandwidth guarantee and variance or variability guarantee on IO bandwidth and latency was kind of de facto standard for defining QoS. But it looks that in multimedia streaming or that kind of situation, we are dealing with like milliseconds or seconds of latency variability, but here we seem to be talking about hours or days of variance in performance. The second question is many of the panelists has mentioned that SSD has a solution or a partial solution to provide SLO, if I am not misunderstood. But for me, it seems like another form of over-provisioning. And even though we use SSD, the SLO problem still, it's not going to go away. Am I missing something, or can I get some explanation of that?
Yeah, so the way I'm looking at it is that there are two things we are hoping will happen. One is, instead of a siloed world, the underlying infrastructure will be like hybrid in nature. So you'll have so much, let's assume flash and so much disk, and they'll be packaged together. So different types of workloads with different characteristics and requirements can now be co-located on the same underlying storage. So the side effect of that is that if you get it wrong, if you specify certain requirements, and then suddenly, you know, in the past, if you realize that was not the right requirement, then you had to migrate your data to a different type of storage, and that was very expensive. Whereas in this world, flash can help or SSDs can help, because now you say, okay, I give you more flash, or I take away flash from you because you don't need it. So the combination of hybrid systems and the fact that you can, you can leverage them.
I mean, sure, but these days there are many different types of LPM drives, from 15,000 LPM drive to 5,200 LPM drives, isn't it? And we can form the storage device with different speed hybrid disks. Then the problem seems to be identical.
Right. So you are absolutely right in that SSDs certainly eliminate certain problems, but they introduce new problems. But in the process, you know, we are improving the user experience, right? The users will be better off even though they have these new problems.
Okay.
I think if I go back to some of the points that Greg mentioned, I feel that although SSDs do not solve all the problems, many of the problems go away. For example, locality of IOs, which in disk is very hard, and it's very hard to even make any predictions out of it. In SSD, that's not a problem anymore. Similarly, the overall variance between random and sequential, worst case, it's like 3 orders of magnitude or 2 orders of magnitude. In SSD, that magnitude may be 1 order or smaller. And I think because of that, I'm hopeful that we would be able to design solutions, QoS solutions, given that now we have something more reasonable to deal with.
But as Greg was also saying, now you have to schedule around the SSD's garbage collection algorithms.
Right, right.
And so you still hit latency spikes, and these latency spikes could now be orders of 1,000 times worse,
right,
depending on vendor. So, in the process, we have a new technology available, and it can, if used properly, it will improve kind of the level of service you can get from, you know, storage systems.
Okay. And let's remember the rainbow, right? So the rainbow says that you don't have to get it perfect. If you can improve the situation significantly, right, you have improved the situation significantly. And I realize that's a fun truism, right? But we're in a pretty bad place right now. And if we can do things that knock out certain aspects of really hard problems, like, for example, the locality variation that I was showing up there becomes much less of an issue, that reduces the variability some and makes the situation better than it is right now.
Right.
And I think that's got to be the target. It's not, is there a single answer that actually makes it just all work, but rather, are there some things we can do that make it less bad? You know,
right.
fewer instances where we're going to miss our guarantees. They're going to be soft. They have to be soft. We're not going to build systems that are sufficiently efficient and can make hard performance guarantees.
Okay.
But so, if we can get rid of a lot of the misses with soft guarantees, yeah, we can be in a world that's better than it is right now with IT organizations. Yeah.
Okay, so one last comment is that if we introduce SSDB storage, then we're going to have another form of SLO problem for SSD.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And other problem is the variability, in terms of variability. Variability in latency in SSD is order of magnitude larger than the hard disk drive because of the garbage collections and spikes.
Yes, that's correct. Yeah. I mean, Greg talked about 100 millisecond spikes in hard disks. In most SSDs you buy today, especially the MLC-based one, you see multi-second spikes in latency.
Correct. Thank you.
Well, I think there you're assuming low-end SSDs. If you go to high-end SSDs...
Again, I mean, quality of service comes down to cost.
Wait, I'm sorry, did you say multi-second?
Yes.
What the heck is it doing?
We've asked that often, and there are explanations, but and things are getting, but that's the state of the world today. Yeah.
Peter Desnoyers, Northeastern. Before my question, I'll point out, yes, I've seen 3 to 4 seconds. I've never seen a SATA interface time out and require a host reboot before,
right,
until I started stress testing SSDs. It's an interesting denial of service because you really do.
It's a brave new world.
Yes.
So.
I was, again, sort of an observation and a question. So in a past life, I was an engineer in the networking industry, and back then, there were a lot of people running around talking about ATM, and they had these wonderful visions, but they all included these incredibly complex quality of service specifications that everyone was going to have to make for every connection, and you know, it would be admitted or denied based on whether the network could provide that. Now, if you can imagine today, your browser having to provide a user-defined specification for every HTTP connection it opens up, you know, you start, and how that could come from a user's configuration, you start realizing this is absurd. Now, if you look at the evolution of networking, you start realizing that a lot of times these requirements for extensive SLO QoS characterizations really are a failure of engineering and science. And you know, a failure to design a system that has good enough properties to distribute resources properly, and so on. Of course, storage has such huge non-linearities that it makes it really hard. But you know, I guess I would ask all of you, you know, what do you think is possible in that area, in terms of what are the things that could make this, you know, do you see any breakthroughs in that area that would make this job easier and allow SLOs to be specified in a way more, you know, at a more aggregate level that users can handle?
I definitely believe that, even with a well-designed system, of course, and you know, you can't say it meets SLOs and so on, you would specify them at an aggregate level, correct? Because there's so many components that, you know, you can't specify. No human being can specify an SLO for every component, you know, manually. So you would either specify them at an aggregate level, or the system would do it for you automatically. So I think that should be kind of the starting point or default condition of the system. So really, all the human time should be going toward managing exceptions. And so I think that's an area where, you know, we need a lot more work, is how do we design this system to minimize those exceptions, and when they occur, to quickly identify and address them. Today, with most storage systems available, there's no easy way to identify what the problem is and to quickly address it, other than kind of creating a separate array set or a separate and then migrating your data set to it, you know, which is getting easier and easier with virtualization, but it's still a big, you know, pain. So, you know, I don't think we'll ever get to the point where people can actually even know what the SLO is for every application. So I think that's something we're going to have to live with for a long time. But we can certainly make it a lot easier to address the exceptions.
Great. And I'd ask, how far do you think you can get with, for instance, good performance isolation to cause people to suffer, you know, the impact of their own?
Right. You know, I mean, Greg has done work on Argon, which provides almost perfect performance isolation, right? And so in terms of specific technical goals like performance isolation or fair resource allocation, we can definitely achieve those. The problem is that real system administrators don't want those particular goals. They want something that solves their source problem, and that problem is bigger than just those specific goals.
Is that even true, Ed? I mean, like, in the case where you have...
I'm not saying it doesn't help.
No, I'm actually arguing almost on the other side.
Yeah.
If you have a multi-tenancy system, then you want performance isolation, but because individual workloads are so variable, they have crosstalk or performance contamination in really strange ways. And so it kind of gets to a point you mentioned, Greg, as well, which is like, well, there's hope for performance insulation or isolation. But I don't see that as that radically different than trying to solve the bigger QoS problem. I thought maybe one or both of you could try to enlighten us about that.
Oh, the difference between those two things?
Yeah, between performance isolation, say a multi-tenant environment, and you know actually trying to provide QoS.
So the way I think of performance insulation is that if you have a workload, does the performance it gets given a certain amount of resource? Yeah. Depend on anybody else or just on what it does with its amount of resource. That is, if it was given the whole resource, would its performance level scaled up to that amount be what you see scaled down or not, right? Is it losing because of interference or is it losing just because of its own properties,
mm-hmm.
right? Yeah, so I think that's what you're talking about as well, right? And that we can address from a technical standpoint. The problem, the difference between that and QoS, you notice I didn't say anything about guaranteeing a particular level of performance. Hmm. I just said that the performance was going to be a function of its own behavior rather than a function of the behavior of other applications, right? Other things interfering with it. So if it swings from sequential to random and it's using disk, I mean, it doesn't have to be using disk, but if it's using disk and it swings from sequential to random, it will go a lot slower, but it will be its own fault, not the fault of somebody else. And you were not specifying what performance level it's going to get. You were just saying that I'm going to make sure it gets what it can get, not what it can get given somebody else doing the weird stuff.
But if you're issuing sequential I/O and another tenant's issuing random I/O, it ends up effectively screwing up your sequentiality. But I should let other people jump in.
Right, but then, so you use quanta to make sure that they don't mix
right.
it up, right?
So,
sugar. There was a thing I wanted to say in response to part of what happened there, but
it's
completely gone. Sorry.
Yeah.
Sorry.
But the thing is that people don't want just isolation. They don't want just fair, they also want cost efficiency, they also want other things, and these are fundamentally conflicting requirements. So you're never going to be able to build a system that does perfectly on all of these points.
Well, I know what I was going to do. I was going to say that there's, and I think you mentioned this, there's multiple kinds of metrics, and we have to keep this in mind when we talk about SLOs, right? So we're focusing a lot on the performance ones, and for the performance ones, I'm pretty much convinced the only way we're going to do it is with a combination of guesswork and refinement over time of what the actual performance goal is. Yeah. So you make a guess on what it is that you're trying to achieve, and then by feedback. And it can go all the way up to the user complaining, right? That's why I say complaint-based. Yeah. But in a system where storage is part of a bigger application and the things talk to each other across layers, you can actually have the bigger application say, hey, you're holding me back. I need you to go faster. And that could be a complaint that happens entirely within the system, right? I mean, it doesn't have to be user human-based, right? And then there are SLO things like availability and reliability and things like that cannot be done in a reactive way, right? If you under-specify your reliability, right, that's generally not a recoverable thing, right? So that you have to do based on risk analysis, you know, much the way people decide how much insurance to buy. Right, you have to do an analysis of what it is you actually need and the cost-benefit associated with that. And there's a feedback loop that has to happen there related to the cost of achieving certain levels of reliability, but it goes in the other direction,
Right. And by the way, the system that Greg described where you could incrementally fix problems and make it better, that also is actually a hard system to design. Storage systems today don't behave like that. You know, today, if you just tweak a knob somewhere, you'll very often get nonlinear behavior. So with existing, you know, with a lot of storage systems today, you actually cannot incrementally get to that kind of state. So designing systems to behave in that way is a big challenge as well.
The rainbow.
Hi, my name is Atul from Microsoft. I have a question on when considering the system design, how important is the factor of predictable performance is? So let's say that typically if an application is built around certain system goals of delivering certain performance or certain reliability metrics, and it gives better performance by sacrificing sometimes on the reliability aspect of it. And here comes a predictability aspect of it. And then it sometimes conflicts with the performance goal and the reliability goal in being more predictable with the performance goals, for example. So when considering a system design, where do you stack, how much weightage should be given to the predictable nature of the application rather than the individual goals of the application?
Yeah, it depends from different workload to workload. So the key trade-off, like a lot of times we look at, is between storage efficiency and performance. So there are some workloads where you don't care about storage efficiency, but you really want to make sure your performance predictability is there. And they're like let's say online transaction processing. Whereas if you have, you know, workloads where, you know, you don't care if the performance, there's a big variance, but you really care about storage efficiency because there's a lot of duplication of data and this workload is not critical, then you would say, okay, I want storage efficiency and I'm willing to sacrifice the predictability. So there are applications in all these different buckets.
I think as an application designer, ideally you should not worry about designing your application to be predictable. You should write the application logic and then let the workload decide how predictable or how variable the actual workload happens to be. And I think it's the job of the underlying storage system to say, let's look at the overall workload and then let's see how predictable it is by looking at the history. And if the variance is very high, then you have to consider that in making your decisions. Because then you can always take some average and then you can take some standard deviations on top, saying we need to make arrangements for that much resource and not something less.
All right, so I'm going to play the devil's advocate then, because that's what I do. Yeah. So I agree that it's the case that you know, it depends is an answer to almost all system questions that start the way yours started, right? Yeah. But I think the answer is more than we do now. The variability and the predictability stuff creates all kinds of weird problems for the storage QoS, but I'll give you a place where it creates bigger problems than for that. And that is in diagnosis of problems in your system, right? So lately, a bunch of my students have been working on you know, trying to automate aspects of problem diagnosis. And with, you know, almost always what you do in order to try to automate those kinds of things is you collect all kinds of data and then you apply various statistics tools, right? And what you're doing is you're saying, well, does it fail this assumption? Does it fail this assumption? You know, the assumption that this is doing okay or the assumption that that's doing okay. And the thing that just absolutely kills the statistics algorithms is variance. The bigger the variance, the bigger the problem has to be before it even shows up as statistically significant, right? And right now, I think it's the case that we more or less design systems across the board, not just storage systems, without thinking about the variance at all, right? Anytime there's a performance optimization to be put in, even though it's only going to improve things sometimes, if we have time in our design cycle, our implementation cycle, to stick it in there, we're going to do it, right? And that's going to cause the variance to go up, which means it's going to be harder to diagnose problems. And if you want to think about where time goes in administering systems, that's the killer, right? Why does my performance suck right now, right? And maybe it fixes itself because it's a variance thing, right? But that's not an answer that's going to be okay to your boss's boss, right? Oh yeah, I'm sorry it didn't work for, I'm sorry the ATMs didn't work for an hour yesterday, right? But it probably won't happen again, and I can't tell you why it happened. That's not going to fly, right? Yeah, and if what's causing it is wild variance that you know is based on us not thinking about variability in our implementations of systems, that's going to be a big problem, right? Or could be a worse problem over time than it is already, right?
So Greg, let me just add a comment to that. So I don't think we should, as you said in your talk, we should not be trying to get the perfection. Mm-hmm. So I think there are some simplifications we can make, and that's what we're making. One is the amount of over-provisioning that you're talking about, rather than what it is today, you know, try to cut it down a bit. So instead of systems being utilized at 20 or 30%, maybe try to make them go to 50 or 60%. So that's I think, one simplification we can make, rather than going to 80 or 90%, like you can do in maybe servers. Second thing is that the qualified service notion that we're talking about, where we package, not single workload, but a combination of, okay, Exchange, this application, like a few applications we want to qualify so that we know how they all interact with each other and behave on a particular storage system. That is good enough for certain markets where customers, it's not black belt markets. So black belt markets, customers want to play with every knob and fine tune it and figure out themselves. But there are a majority of other customers who are good or happy with what pre-configured solution that you give them and say, for these workloads, these things work great. And if you have a problem, it's easy for us to diagnose because this is a qualified solution. So any diff I do between what your system is and what I think is the mother solution, I can very quickly diagnose it and tell you what the problem is. Hey, you said these are the workload characteristics. These are what we are seeing. This is the configuration, but you made these changes and so on. So I think that kind of qualified approach can help you take closer. It won't solve the problem because, you know, obviously there are customers who are going to be changing things. But I think these kind of simplification baby steps, if we can take, it will at least make this whole thing usable for, a large class of customers.
Can I just say one more comment? So regarding the doing performance troubleshooting in presence of variance, actually VMware recently acquired a company called Integrion, and they have this solution where they look at your stats, so they get like thousands of stats for all the VMs and servers, and they look at the stats for at least 3 days, but I think recommendation is 7 days, and they compute the operating range for each stat, saying if it's within this range, it's normal. If it's above that range, it's anomalous. And they have actually considered this variance of the stat to actually get to that range. And now the anomalies that they raise on their UI is based on if you are outside of this range or not. Mm-hmm. So I think people are considering that in analysis.
I want to take a position that I think a lot of this conversation seems pretty premature. You wouldn't be able to get someone at Google to tell you... I'm Alex Lloyd from Google again. You wouldn't be able to get someone from Google to tell you, how should I trade off throughput of Gmail spam processing pipelines versus blogger latency? And I bet most enterprise environments would have similar problems sort of making those sorts of trade-offs. At the other end, none of us really understands or can describe concisely the performance of a single tenanted tiered storage array with a bunch of SSDs and, you know, some of these maybe shingled disks we heard about earlier underneath that. It seems to me that we're years away from having like a single predictable performance one of these systems that you could then do this iterating feedback loop with just one user. Before to arrive at a reasonable amount of capacity you need in a single tenanted environment before you can obsess about defining SLOs at layers in the middle of this entire stack. I guess I'm arguing we should be excited if we really have predictable performance from some of these things in a few years, and that's, I think, would be a more practical and fruitful place to put energy than in this kind of hypothetical and long-running question about how to articulate SLOs that aren't implementable anyway.
I think. Right. So I'm not sure who you disagreed with, but I at least stood up and told you were never going to have a predictable model of the devices, because I don't think you are. I think that the devices are just going to continue to have large amounts of variability in them as a fundamental feature of what they do. if anything, they're going to get worse because more and more schemes for how to adapt to different kinds of behaviors are going to happen inside the devices. I know you're going to do it in NetApp, right? Yeah, but the disk guys are doing it inside of disks, and the firmware guys for the SSDs are doing it inside of the SSDs, right? They're all looking to do something clever.
And maybe we should be, people keep bringing up, maybe we should be less fatalistic about that too, and pushing as a community to say, no, we need wider interfaces, and we need more control over this, and NetApp should be able to decide when the SSD, you know, does its background cleanup and so on.
See, I would argue for not viewing it as fatalistic, but view it as a given, and then think, okay, well, how do I cope with that being a given and build my bigger system? So at Google, I mean, you brought up Google, you work there, mm-hmm. You do something. You don't do nothing right now to decide how much resource to have in place to use for the various services, right? You decide how many more computers to buy and how many computers over which to farm out the work for, say, the bloggers and the work for, say, the Gmail.
Right, right? And it's the feedback versus complaints algorithm that everyone else has, of course.
That's right. And so things that you can do that tighten that loop and save you a certain range of over-provisioning are a win, mm-hmm. right? And mm-hmm. I think we're pretty much all talking about that. Yeah. You're never gonna get this perfect SLO up front. You might, for very specific workloads where somebody's willing to put in the amount of effort that it would take to do that, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, but in general, you're not. And you should just embrace that. It's not fatalistic, it's love.
Why is it something to embrace that, you know, we have to leave the scheduling of each layer's background activities up to that layer, instead of to some centralized controller that understands the various priorities of these activities, you know, understands there's a really urgent user request right now. Maybe we should defer this background cleanup until 2 hours from now when I know my workload's going to drop off. Or it seems like sort of accepting the commodity packaging of these different devices, especially in an enterprise environment, is just leading to a bunch of researchers being consumed and trying to reverse engineer what, you know, Intel is doing.
Right.
Okay. Yep. Yeah. Sorry. Well, okay. Somebody else can go first, but I'm coming back to you, Google guy, because we're having it out on this.
No, I think that's a good idea. I think that storage vendors actually should expose a lot more of the buried state in the system. So, like, when is it doing disk reconstruction? When is it doing garbage collection? When is it checkpointing maps or metadata information? And also provide hooks whereby some of those activities can be scheduled. And, you know, certainly, well, you know, we use SSDs to design our storage systems, and we would find those kind of facilities, if they were made available by the SSD vendors, to be very usable, you know, very useful. And I'm sure that our customers would also find, like VMware, I'm sure would love to have access to that kind of information as well, because then they could incorporate that into their performance models as well. So I think that would be really useful. Of course, we also need somewhat automated algorithms for doing this for, you know, customers who don't care about it, and they just want the system to handle it. But I think exposing buried information like that would be really useful and would also help maybe the different vendors come to a closure in terms of what is a standard model, say, that, you know, people could use for designing quality of service systems.
This has been a great discussion. I'm hesitant to try to cut things off. We're running slightly over time, but I would propose that if people are willing, we try to let the drain the remaining queue, and anyone who has to leave is welcome to leave, of course.
All right, well, I don't have the self-control, though, not to answer this.
So, all right, Craig.
So you invoked the most enterprises would want thing, right? And in most enterprises, you don't have control over the vast majority of things that make up your stack, right? Google's actually sort of an exception to this, and I'll get back to Google in a second. But in most enterprises, you're probably buying somebody's storage devices inside of somebody's storage server that you're going to then use, say, inside of somebody's VM layer, hypervisor layer, whatever.
Exactly. And so the point
is, applications of various kinds tiered on top of each other.
Reduce the number of somebodies who are involved.
Well,
right?
Unless you get them all to one, right?
Let NetApp pick the somebodies inside the NetApp.
Yeah, yeah, which is what Google could do. Google could decide we're going to have one, and it's going to be us, right? And I'll get back to you in a sec. But you're not going to get agreement between Oracle and VMware and NetApp and Seagate to decide which one of them it is.
That's right.
Because each one of them is trying to make a business out of being the one who is providing value that is necessary for the enterprise, right? So right off the bat, you have a practical non-starter, and I can't believe the theory guy and the panel here has to be the guy to point it out. But let's get back to Google, right? So Google, you could do this with everything but the hardware. And even the hardware, I mean, you guys, you could come down like a ton of bricks on people and get them to build you exactly what you want. This is what you've done with the server backplanes and stuff like that, right? So let's just say you got the hardware fixed. You wouldn't even be close to having solved the problem. I know lots of people that work at Google, and you guys are building software on top of software on top of software where the independent groups that own the software layers, the group that owns Bigtable, and the group that owns Google File System, and the group that owns this, and the group that owns that, they are not centralizing control over all the key decisions that would affect variability of performance.
And a lot of people are on a mission to fix that.
And
a lot of people are on a mission to fix that. You're right, that's a disaster. And so, trying to spread the word that everyone should be trying to fix that, not just Google. We shouldn't be the only vertically integrated stack.
From top to bottom?
Yeah.
Right.
At least, layers instead of every single vendor be its own.
Right. That's true. Microsoft could probably do it, too.
I think having a single layer is not the only solution to the problem. I think if NetApp or Tintri, they design an array that says, once you set this kind of requirement on a VM, you tell us it needs within 10 milliseconds or 20 milliseconds, we'll give you that 90% of the time. Then VMware can take that value and say, here is a VM. We give you that kind of storage performance. We give you this kind of CPU and memory performance. And we give something at a higher level that we expose then to the users. So I think it's not that you need one company to do everything, but if every company does a good job in their own layer, eventually we can do something much better than what we have today.
Right.
And what we have today is, in terms of storage, is very low. Yeah.
And actually, I'm not as pessimistic as Greg in expecting companies to work together. They actually will do so surprisingly when there are big customers and money involved. Mm-hmm.
But work together doesn't necessarily mean yield the floor.
Right. I mean, they're never going to stop fighting over, the business, but they can also work together. But even if only a small fraction of customers actually use the exposed information, I think, it is customers like Google, and even VMware who use these facilities which drive a lot of the innovation. So even if a small fraction of the people actually use it, that still helps kind of drive the innovation and improve the system.
Next question.
Steve Swanson from UCSD. So what's the, if we got SLOs working as well as possible, and if we solved all these problems to the best of our ability, how does the world change? Like, how much better do things get and in what way?
So how over-provisioned is your storage?
It will reduce the amount of over-provisioning you're doing. I think, end of the day, I think that will be money in the bank for the providers.
I think from VMware point of view, if that happens, things which are not virtualized today because of storage unpredictability, we think all the applications would be virtualized. We would be able to virtualize all tier one apps, which may be super IO sensitive, but given a tight guarantee or some sort of high degree of SLO from the storage, we would be able to do that. And then you could pretty much run any service that you want within a VM.
So cost savings.
Probably also, a lot. Also agility, right? Flexibility.
And you want, okay, go ahead.
So I was trying to think of how to ask this question, but it's really more of a story than a question. So you have a company where, let's say, the finance department, for some reason, doesn't want to keep track of records over the last, 20 minutes. They don't care if a crash takes out the 20 minutes of most recent records. I don't know why, but they just don't care. And the DBA doesn't know that that means he could configure his journaling to be asynchronous and not flush on every single transaction commit. But the storage system doesn't know any of this. The storage system is just seeing append fsync, append fsync, append fsync. So, that's my story, and I'm interested in how SLOs could change this story for the better.
I think, I don't know if you remember my first slide where I said people would ask for per VM decay controls, where if you are running a VM and you are running some operation there that you don't want to even persist after 1 hour, then if the storage array allows you to provide such control, saying this data doesn't have to be reliable, doesn't even have to persist. You may have completely different sort of design or the IOs going for that particular data. And I think eventually if arrays, for example, Tintree, if they already have visibility into that these blocks are belonging to these VMDKs and they can build more and more controls at the per VMDK level, and you would have a situation where you won't be overpaying for resources, which currently today you will, because let's say you put 10 of them on a LUN and the LUN is backed up every day. You are basically backing up all the blocks on the LUN which may belong to VMDKs that don't need to be backed. And I think if this pans out well enough, then we would see all those savings for the customers. Right.
And also, if you have appropriate controls and it's easy enough to use, then you could actually expose those things to the application owner as well. It doesn't have to be, because today, especially in a virtualized environment, the system administrator just manages the virtual infrastructure. He doesn't know much about the actual applications that are running on the system. In your case, in that example, only the person who owns the application knows that, right? So if he could actually go to a self-managed portal on the, you know, on the infrastructure and say, okay, for this I don't need this feature, I want it to run, you know, X faster, I'm willing to make that trade-off, then they could specify themselves. So, yeah.
But now you're, so I guess I guess what I'm trying to get across is the bad stuff that happens when the database is misconfigured dwarfs the bad stuff that can happen when the storage layer is misconfigured or is too generic. And there are a lot of databases out there, different ones with very different implementations and different maintainers. And I guess I'm sort of trying to see how the politics of SLOs is going to work. How are you going to get the storage performance through the stupid DBA that doesn't know he should be turning on transaction no sync up to the financial guy who owns the application? How are you going to push through that middle layer that's not working with you?
Right.
So two things. One, I'm not convinced that based on the story you told or anything else really, that the DBAs can screw it up worse than we can. We can certainly screw it up badly, right? And I think Ajay's example is a perfect example of that. If you're backing up a boatload of stuff you don't need to be backing up, you can create all kinds of performance problems that are much worse than a single misconfigured DBA or database, right? But also, you have to remember that we can't fix that misconfigured DBA by not writing the stuff to disk when the database says to do so, because if we do, there's problems much bigger than performance that you're going to pay there, right? If you don't write log first, you get data corruption, and data corruption is the worst case scenario, right? Bad performance is not the worst case scenario.
Yeah, I mean, that's the point. It's an interesting problem to see how SLOs will sort of spread through applications up from the storage layer, I guess is what I'm saying.
So, I mean, with respect to that question, let's say you had this mythical device that always gave you 1 millisecond latency, every single time, always, right? You could think of that as an SLO for that device, and then now you can build all kinds of stuff on top of it. So, I mean, layered is not impossible, it's just hard to do. If higher layers can rely on something from the lower layers, it's possible. Now, of course, this is a mythical disk, and no such thing actually exists. So there's a few points, Irfan Ahmad, VMware. So there's a few points that seem interesting, a couple of little stories. So if you ship a package through FedEx, even if Greg is the one shipping it, you're going to end up in a situation where you have some options to pick from, 2-day, 3-day, 5-day, whatever. Right? Suppose you pick the 2-day. Now, that's like an SLO. Okay, it's actually kind of even more. It's like an SLA because you actually sign a document and they actually sign the document, right? And most of the time, your package gets to its destination, but the plane could crash, right? There could be a flood in the warehouse. So this idea of SLO, variability, and just because there's a disk that occasionally gives you 1 second, I mean, I see those as distractions to what we're trying to get at. That's not the core issue. Sure, we can talk about all kinds of variants. Sure, we can talk about, 1% of the time there's a problem. But I'd encourage us to think of, to kind of learn that and characterize that whenever possible, but do what FedEx does, okay? Which is, yes, planes crash. It's 0.01% of the time. oh, flooding happens, and this is 0.5% of the time. And you know what? Business goes on because, transportation is something that the world is built around, right? And we've managed to make it work, and with SLOs. So let's not talk about worst cases hindering us. Let's talk about it from the point of view of characterizing it and managing it and buying insurance on top of it once in a while, okay? And that should be acceptable. And I think that loosens constraints in the system, and it changes the conversation. And we no longer are looking at graphs that are, log scale and still sitting way the heck out on the right end. So I think we should stop talking about that. And start talking about, okay, what, 90th percentile latency, 80th percentile latency, or something like that, right? The kind of thing that real world, people would do. If you don't have comments on that, I can move on to the next story.
Well, I support that, and that's the whole premise of the qualified SLOs that we're talking about.
Yeah.
Is where you look at well-known workloads and many customer cases, they're deploying these apps together. You study, you have well-defined configurations for that. And the
other side would be that FedEx also does this, and they kind of keep track of what day of the year, there's a lot of packages that ship, and they once in a while get it wrong, and they manage that. I mean, you just deal with it, okay?
But I would point out that your FedEx example sort of works, but really doesn't work, right? The amount of variability they're dealing with relative to the mean is much lower than we're dealing with, and the solution that they've taken to SLO specification is a very simple tier process. You do the one day next morning, the one day anytime tomorrow, the 2 day, the 5 day, right? There's like 6 tiers or something like that, and that's it, right? You're not saying I want it there at 11:57 p.m. tomorrow, plus or minus 3 minutes.
Yeah, and I didn't say that. I mean, I
understand, but what I'm, I guess what I'm saying is that the range of options that most people think about when they think about specifying SLOs are way bigger for storage environments than FedEx.
But Greg, I think that's why I think that the top-down versus bottom-up approach, I think in top-down, you get overwhelmed with all the knobs, as you mentioned, mm-hmm. and I don't think that will work. Instead, bottom-up, where you a priori say, okay, I have, as either the FedEx example or something, but more than 5 or 6, it will be intense, but I think that is more tractable. Because then you say, I know this kind of performance, this kind of protection, and this kind of storage efficiency can coexist.
And I'll give you a fun related thing for the US mail, since the variability topic is sort of one
notice
of the things.
Notice I did not
kicking
use that example.
I know, but the US, actually the Postal Service is pretty darn good, right? And one of the things at one point with their high priority mail that they noticed is that they could make it go a lot faster than they promised. And in fact, they started to do that. And then they stopped doing it.
Sure.
And there was a report that eventually came out on why they stopped doing it. The reason they stopped doing it was people counted on a certain degree of delay in delivery of things. Well, people were planning when things would arrive based on how far in advance they sent them. And somebody got, a number of people got hosed by it, by announcements, for example, arriving too soon.
Yeah. Right. Well, there's that problem, and then there's actually a more subtle one, which is there is this issue of managing the variance around the mean. There's an issue of the Six Sigma style of things of, look, my packages often sit at the FedEx Sunnyvale office, which is literally 2 miles away, and they'll sit there for 2 days, and because there's some value, there's some perceived value in consistent latency.
Uh-huh.
And I feel that's one of the knobs that I'd like to see people start experiment with and say, look, okay, I have this I/O sitting in my buffer. I could give it to you, but I'm not going to give it to you.
Yeah.
Because you said 1 millisecond. And I think those are the stuff. And then so now you start to get into actually manipulating that mean.
Right. Okay? I think sysadmins would love that too. Because
sorry?
Then sysadmins would love it because then they could dial it back up when users complain.
Yeah, and exactly. So
you can also zero in on the mean that way, right? If you can slow it down, you can find out how slow you could get away with.
Yeah. You're fine. I actually suggest we take the rest of this offline. I appreciate everyone's patience in staying late, and I'd like to thank all our panelists.